Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Your name's not down, you're not coming in. Your name's not down, you're not coming in.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part tonight, the coming storm. As mentioned by LL MC Lance Murdoch last week, what's going to happen? The Great Reset won't be possible without a fair amount of disruption, shock doctrine therapy for the masses. With Britain's exit from the single market at the end of December, will that be the inflection point? Democracy clashing against the oligarchy with a collapse in the nation's finances, possibly much wider around the world. Will we see disruption and collapse in our utilities, gas, water, electricity, in travel and communications or not? Will we see new kinds of impersonal policing to keep the population scared and indoors? If the disruption is big enough to the food chain, will some have to forage in the countryside even for food, wishing not so many badgers had been culled? Also, as foreign policy is ruled out of the final presidential debates in the United States, surely that means war is coming. They don't want to make any commitments this time. Or is it just to help Trump so he can hide his support for a coming Israeli war on Iran? Might be that simple, mightn't it? Also, the links between Aleister Crowley and the Zionists, the OTO, the Golden Dawn, and the Zionist Project, explained by Dot Joiner extraordinaire David Livingston, who talks to me about his latest book, Ordo Ab Chao, the evil killer of PC Yvonne Fletcher, or one of the greatest African statesmen of all time. Bayoneted up the backside by a NATO-supported mob, the late great Colonel Gaddafi talks about US assassins over the last 50 years. And you've heard about the Bay of Pigs and bringing in the greenback dollar. Well, Gaddafi suggests another reason why JFK may have been assassinated, and that's his speech at the United Nations from way back in 2008, 2009, around about that time. I'm not sure the exact date. I'll tell you when we talk about it. But Martin, this week, lots to talk about as ever. The main thing, I suppose, we'll be talking a bit more about, I think, about the lockdown and the various measures, COVID measures, in the second hour. But this move in Wales has not gone down well amongst ordinary Welsh people at all. In an hour's time, another lockdown, all businesses closing, etc., for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, and that's the decision of the Welsh government, as you know.
Not going down well, though.
Well, they're elected
amongst ordinary people.
They're elected by the ordinary people, and if they're not happy,
they weren't elected on this issue, were they? No. This is the interesting thing: is these politicians were elected to do with basic loyalties to the parties, but they're now doing something which no one has ever asked them about.
No, I mean, what they're doing is they're agreeing with what the Sage people said some weeks ago, that a two-week lockdown was probably necessary. And in England, they're probably going to have to do a two-week lockdown or more at some point. The Welsh have decided to bite the bullet.
Well, as I say, we'll be talking about that a bit more later, including a little bit of an investigation that I've been doing into the origins of the stand-up movement and some of the affiliations of those. And what we're calling Operation Purbright Phase 2, a leaked document purporting to explain what is going on. So this is enabling us, hopefully, to put a bit of flesh on the bones of what Lance Murdoch was saying last week, the guy that did the talk about Serco. Martin, the credit rating, though, this is getting to the nitty-gritty, I suppose. UK's credit ratings have been downgraded by Moody's again. The agency's warning that growth will be meaningfully weaker than anticipated and points to problems in Britain's governance. Now, what do they mean by that, and how important is this Moody's change?
Well, if you remember, we used to have a AAA credit rating, but we lost it when Osborne was the Chancellor, because he carried out too much austerity. So he basically was saying we've got to keep our credit rating, so we're carrying out austerity. The problem with that is that it starts to push the economy down, and then you lose your credit rating anyway, which anybody who'd studied macroeconomics and understood it would have realised was going to be the case. But in actual fact, our credit rating is still, compared to many other countries, quite high. But of course there is an issue, which is the fact that we haven't controlled COVID, unlike some more successful countries.
Well, that's not why we're being downgraded, though, is it?
It is, because the economy's going down because of all the problems that we know.
You say the economy's going down, but they're basically, what Moody's are saying is that you're spending too much, the government's spending too much.
No, it's not about spending, it's about whether you...
That's what they're saying.
No, listen, Tony, it's partly to do with spending and basically running up debt, but it's also, you can run up debt as long as you've got a means to pay it back, and that's when you lose your credit rating, and it becomes clear that you can't pay up the debt back that you've already run up.
Okay, so we've lowered the rating, they have lowered the rating from AA3... to AA3 from AA2. So is that really important or not?
Not that important in the big scheme of things. And in actual fact, of course, you can actually borrow money relatively easily at relatively low rates until the crash, of course. And then money was, you know, that big. And of course, we haven't had a crash.
Britain is the world's sixth biggest economy, and it shrunk by the most amongst the group of seven nations in the second quarter. Its public debt topped £2 trillion. That's $2.6 trillion, surpassing 100% of GDP. Britain's growth, says Moody's, had been meaningfully weaker than expected and is likely to remain so in the future. Whereas China, I was just reading the other day, has got something like posted about 5% growth.
Well, that's
right. In the same quarter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can now see what's happening in the global economy is that countries, and particularly China, which have actually weathered this crisis successfully, are now back to growth. Whereas the countries where they haven't managed the crisis successfully are now going to be stuck in a permanently low growth.
Britain trajectory. Should have been a more authoritarian state like China, should we?
It's not a question of an authoritarian state. We're talking about governance, is whether you can actually do the job properly. And of course, New Zealand is not an authoritarian state like China, and they have done the job properly, unlike us.
But there's no, I mean, we have this discussion every week, if you can call it that. It's you making a ridiculous point, which is that we were at the same state as New Zealand and that we could have done what they did. They had something like 10 infections where we had probably tens of thousands. So obviously the two aren't really comparable at all.
Well, I would argue, and it has been argued, Tony, that we could have locked down earlier than we did, because other countries did.
No, they didn't.
Our neighbouring countries did.
No, they
Ireland was... knocked down before we did. Well, then Northern Ireland followed.
Maybe a few weeks before, or maybe just a few days before. The World Health Organization advice came the 16th of March. Mm-hmm. So when before that should we have known?
Well, the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defence Forces...
This is the Israeli Intelligence Services. Nobody knew about that.
The Defence Intelligence Agency
of
the United States...
You know that now, but you weren't saying this at the time, were you?
No, I wouldn't, but the reason... Why do you think Britain was not told what was going on?
It's easy with the benefit of hindsight of saying these things, isn't it?
Listen. Tony, if we're going to have a serious discussion about
that's why I'm absolutely forcing you to be logical about what you're saying, because it was impossible, really, to lock down before we knew, number one, that there was a virus, and then secondly, that there was this advice from the World Health Organization. Now, Boris did flim-flam for a few days, but then he did what you would have advised him to do, and you certainly weren't saying anything at the time. And now you're then quoting intelligence services' secret reports that we should have supposedly known about.
All right, let's disentangle two things. We can talk about the what you might call the biological warfare aspects of this. Somebody in the British intelligence services, MI6, certainly will have known. Will they have told Boris? Probably not, because of course the strategy is to mess up the Chinese, let it flow back over the Western countries, including US and Britain, so that you've got an excuse to bail the banks out and carry out QE, which of course has happened, and lots of people have made loads of money out of that, and of course Trump's people were telling the people in Wall Street it is much worse than we're saying in public, so sell now, and that's exactly what they did, and that came out in the debate between Trump and Biden yesterday. So in actual fact, it's pretty common consensus that Britain's management of this crisis has been incompetent. It's not just me saying this, lots of people are saying it. And of course the figures bear it out.
In which case, it's the whole of Europe's management of the crisis that's been incompetent, not just Britain.
No, indeed.
That is all those lovely EU countries too.
Indeed, lots of countries have made a very big hash of this, and other countries, for example, Kerala.
Sweden.
Sweden
or Belarus.
Belarus is actually, it's quite interesting because, of course, nobody goes to Belarus and nobody leaves very much. So in actual fact, they're in a very similar position to Norway.
Well, they do from Ukraine and Russia.
Yes, all right. But anyway, the point I'm making, Tony, is this. There is now, after months of this crisis, it's now clear some places have done a lot better than others. We are in the not so good category.
Well, you're talking about New Zealand as doing superbly well, but the problem is, of course, that if the virus catches hold in New Zealand now, it would be much more devastating because people don't have immunity, the young people particularly.
Well, we don't have immunity in this country, and I don't think they're going for herd immunity anytime soon in China. They're going to carry on growing their economy, concentrating on building their own domestic market, and they're going to pull ahead as the rest of the world goes into depression. That is, if you mock Max Kaiser on RT, he's absolutely clear about this. This is the decisive point where the Chinese become the dominant.
Well, I thought they already were, actually.
Yes, but this is going to be the turning point where they really are, because the American economy is definitely stuffed.
So does that mean the United States wants to have a war with them now?
Well, that's pretty much what they've been flagging up, isn't it, Tony? That's the only answer, isn't it?
Well, it's the only answer if you're a bad loser, and the US does seem to be a bit like that. Yeah. Also, you look at the looking at the finances and how much it's more it's teetering on the brink now than it was back in 2008. 230 billion commercial property crashes looming. Treasury watchdog sounds the alarm as millions work from home. The value of commercial buildings is falling by about 14% this year, the OBR says. Transactions in 2020 to 21 are expected to plummet by 23%. So, I mean, this can't be sustained, can it? Actually, I think there's an enormous great commercial property bubble been built up over the last 20 years anyway.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it's only been sustained, we're only being sustained at the moment by massive QE and government intervention. So people who imagine that somehow we've escaped a crash are wrong. There will at some point be a crash. The right-wing economists are quite right about that. You can't just print money. Ultimately, it blows up. But, of course, the Chinese may be able to ride that out because their economy is growing. And if you've got a growing economy, you can service whatever debts have been developed. If you haven't, you're stuffed.
So how is this going to play out then?
Well, of course, the problem for the Chinese is that their major export markets are all going into depression. So that's their customer base disappearing. But fortunately for them, only about 15% of their GDP is dependent on exports. They're a big export machine, and they export all over the world, become the workshop of the world in the last 30 years. But in actual fact, most of their economy is homegrown. So they'll do what the United States did in the 19th century, and they will basically concentrate on developing their national economy because there isn't much happening in the rest of the world. And, of course, if you're a small developing country in the rest of the world, it'll be pretty obvious which side is winning, and the east wind will prevail over the west wind, as Mao Zedong famously said.
Well, I thought it would be useful to follow up on a report that we did a few weeks ago with Sean Miriam O'Sullivan. He's a street preacher here in Bristol. And just walking through the city centre yesterday, came across him. He wasn't actually doing the preaching anymore. He's got a court case, apparently in Swindon, coming up next year, but he hasn't been given a date for it, which suggests that it might be that the charges are dropped against him. Apparently he was being charged with harassment and racism for something that he said about Islam in reply to a question someone else asked him about. And there are all sorts of problems here with harassment, freedom of speech, when it comes to various faiths, because each faith is basically saying something different about another faith. I suppose you could say dissing another faith, Martin, couldn't you? How do we resolve this sort of problem that Sean's run into here?
Well, I mean, what it seems to me that this has been put out of proportion. I mean, he's making his speeches about his faith. Somebody asks him a question about it, and he responds to that question. People should be able to have debates about religious or other matters without it turning into a fight and into people prosecuted.
Okay, how do you separate legitimate comment about your beliefs from hate speech?
Well, that's a very good question. We could say that anybody should just be allowed to say anything. That's the easiest thing. Anybody's just allowed to say anything. And, of course, we've seen recently in France where this teacher has been basically killed because he encouraged his class to debate whether these... He didn't say these... You know, he said to Muslims in the class, you know, if you don't want to watch this, you can go out. But we're going to look at these things and discuss whether they should be allowed to be printed or whatever. But of course, if the cartoons concerned had been basically directed at the Jewish faith, then it's quite likely they would have been banned as incitements to hatred. Now, in other words, what we've got to get, if we're going to have any rationality about this, is it's got to be one rule for everybody. Now, either anybody can say anything, or we've got some rules about what you can and can't say. And that, of course, then begs questions about what is legitimate and what isn't.
Well, the fact is, of course, you're absolutely right about the laws about Holocaust denial and caricaturing of the Jewish faith in France are pretty strong, Martin, aren't they? So it's, in a way, a kind of provocation to do a similar sort of thing to Islam as is illegal in France against Judaism.
Yes, and I think that then causes resentment and so on. But, of course, there's still no justification for murdering people that you don't agree with. These issues are going to be very tense. By and large, we've got freedom of speech to say what we like, but if you do use inflammatory language, then you have got to expect that people are going to get angry.
But one person, sort of thing that happens. I mean, some people would say there's quite a lot of inflammatory language in the Bible.
Well, indeed there is, and therefore it's, of course, and don't forget it's this idea that everybody should have freedom of speech is a relatively modern one. Throughout most of history, people have believed that you should shut up and do as you're told, and the people in charge know best.
Well, also, I mean, think from the Enlightenment, it depends what you mean by modern, doesn't it? But the whole point here, surely, is that you can say what you want so long as you're not actually inciting a criminal act. Now, that criminal act has got to be a sort of traditional criminal act, not some sort of, you know, dislike of a particular group in society. This is absolutely crucial to make this distinction. That is this an is what you're saying incitement to commit crime or not? And putting forward your religious beliefs generally is not.
No, it's not. I mean, look what happened to David Starkey when he came out with that remark about too many damn blacks. Now, he wasn't prosecuted. He was allowed to say it. But, of course, what then happened is various organisations of which he was a part said they didn't want him on their list of sponsors anymore, because they're entitled to say, well, you can say that, and we can say, well, goodbye, we don't want to talk to you anymore. So, we all know how sensitive this is all becoming. And I'm generally in favour of the more freedom of speech, the better.
Anyway.
And I think the people that say that people on the left are trying to close down freedom of speech, I'm prepared to say anything you like, as long as no crime for mummies when we start accusing you of being terrorists and murderers, which they are.
Okay,
MI6, well, for example.
Sean's taken issue this week, and he's been speaking about this down in Broadmead, about the mayor, Marvin Rees, flying flags for the transgender people. But anyway, so here he is when I spoke to him yesterday talking about this and a couple of other issues.
I've done the drugs, I've done the wealth, and I've done the poverty. I'm a man as a revelation of Jesus Christ, that every single person can also obtain. And when you obtain it, you will realise that there's nothing on this earth that can compare to the love of God.
Yeah, well, I spoke to the mayor because the mayor says that he's a Christian. So the mayor is promoting things that Christians don't believe. But I wasn't standing against that. I was saying that Christians should have a right just as well as the LBG community. We can't say that the Christian is against the LBGT. It's actually both ways. People are saying that the LBGT will not let the Christians have their flag put up. So I believe that both can have.
Where are these flags? What's going on with the flag?
Oh, it's the mayor's office. And Marvin is denying his faith. He claims to be a Christian, but typical of Marvin Rees, he can't make his mind up. I worry about him being the mayor of this city because he's very, very mixed up man. He's very unstable, so I do worry about this city and where the money is going in this city. If Marvin is a Christian, that he can't put up certain things. The flag that he put up is actually goes against his own teaching, so to put that flag up, he would have to deny his own faith.
Well, he's apparently a lay preacher up at Christ Church in Clifton.
Marvin Rees, unfortunately, is a picker and chooser of what he wants to believe. The ministry's growing. We've got teams of people coming out. We're starting to get across the cities and put a lot of conferences on. Awaken the Streets is definitely growing. The good thing about what we believe in, people's got a choice. They can walk on by, but I'm going to stand and preach the truth. We've had about 9 baptisms since I've last seen you, and we've had people. This young guy here has been raised up through our ministry of preaching. We're starting to influence America, Russia, and Europe with the gospel of Jesus Christ. what a mess the corona is. The government don't know what's going on. They don't know what they're talking about. Boris Johnson's dad's been exposed with no mask on. I don't see his father getting fined. It's double standards with this government. It's all an agenda. It's all about control. This is all heading towards a controlled system. It's heading towards a system that is going to push out the poor, and it's heading towards a system that is also pushing out the agenda of Christ, because Jesus warned that there'd be a spirit of control in the name of Jesus.
You're one of those people that holds up a big sign saying the end of the world is nigh. But what you're saying, it seems to me, is that's actually a good thing.
Yeah, no, I'm someone who reads the Bible, and I see the times coming, but my message is always to preach love and the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sean Miriam O'Sullivan on Facebook, Awaken the Streets YouTube channel. God bless you. Read your Bible.
Okay, so that's Awaken the Streets, Martin. Since I last saw Sean, he seems to have various people doing his preaching for him. You know, he's managed to convert some people, and they're the ones actually doing the talking. So he's down in Broadmead quite a lot these days. But, you know, this is an apocalyptic issue. I think most times when we've had difficulties, even, you know, during World War II, for example, there'd be people come out with these placards, wouldn't there, saying the end of the world is nigh.
Well, as you know, there are various sects in Christianity and a whole spectrum of views. So, you know, you can't really generalise. I mean, he's got obviously his views. I'm not quite clear what they all are, because we've only heard a short clip there. But there's plenty of other people with very different views who would also claim to be Christians.
What about this whole business of lesbian, gay, bi rights and Christianity? Are they two compatible?
Well, some Christians would say they're definitely compatible, and some, obviously, like him, feel that they're not. But they've, you know, he doesn't necessarily speak for all Christians. In fact, I know for a fact that he doesn't.
No, of course he doesn't. He definitely does. I can say that for sure. So it's all about interpretation, really. Anyway, I thought we'd have a look at some of the stories, more stories, national stuff this week, particularly around this whole idea of the organised crime gangs, which have apparently stolen around about $2 billion. Some other commentators have said nearer to $4 billion of furlough cash. The National Audit Office has found this. Criminals have almost certainly claimed between $1 and $1.95 billion, pocketing money intended for employees of ailing businesses. Up to $2 billion of money from the government's furlough scheme has gone straight into the hands of organised crime, Martin, apparently. Straight in. Literally, it's a similar scheme which was scammed a few years ago. They've used the same kind of basic nuts and bolts. And so, of course, those that scammed the previous scheme have scammed this one too.
Well, it's an ongoing problem, isn't it? Any system that you put in place, some people are going to try and abuse it.
So whilst for honest people, this is a loan scheme, for dishonest people, it's a gift.
Well, the problem with it being a loan scheme in the first place meant that many people didn't apply for it, and it was very difficult to get the loans. So, you know, there's issues about whether it was well designed in the first place. And of course, it was all cobbled together at the last minute without much thought.
Well, I wonder whether it was. I wonder whether there some people connected with organised crime and the Treasury have decided that this is a great scheme because some of their friends would make a load of money out of it. I mean, we know, don't we, that Goldman Sachs is a criminal organisation. It's where Ricky Sunak was. You know, he's basically a Goldman Sachs man. We had this whole thing, didn't we, of the technocrat governments around Europe over the last few years, almost all of them tracing their roots back to Goldman Sachs, and he does too.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, BlackRock in the US has probably taken over from Goldman Sachs as the vampire squid on the face of humanity, as Ellen Brown puts it. The fact is that the collapse of the banking system in 2008... that was largely due to openly criminal behaviour by the senior people in the system. And far from being punished, they were rewarded. And, of course, there's been a further, even bigger bailout now under the cover of the COVID crisis. And all the same people have made loads and loads of money on insider trading and so on. And there's no end in sight to any of this. And ultimately, of course, there's going to be a showdown about who's going to pay for the crisis. And there's going to have to be structural adjustment for the bourgeoisie, which means them losing everything. But they're not going to go quietly.
Would that be a good thing? The bourgeoisie? You're a traditional Marxist that hates the bourgeoisie.
Well, no. The thing is, if they are criminals, then they should face the full weight of the law, should they not?
I mean, surely it's mostly the middle classes are going to suffer from all this, and these people, the criminals, are going to just scoot off.
Well, what's going to happen is that the middle classes will lose their minimal savings. The poor will be really screwed, and they will walk away with the money. But of course, at that point, people are going to say, "Well, hang on a minute, what's in this for us?" I mean, they're not going to be able to provide basic security in the society for most of the population, and that's going to happen across the planet. And there's going to be a very testing time for everybody.
I would put it to you that Goldman are just as powerful as they've ever been here in the UK. Forget BlackRock. I mean, they're mainly in the US doing stuff over there.
Yeah.
The UK regulators have fined Goldman Sachs over a Malaysian fraud after 2.2 billion enforcement. The UK regulators joined others around the globe to level heavy penalties on subsidiaries of Goldman Sachs for its role in the fraud scheme, which looted billions of dollars from a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund and used the money to fund Hollywood movies, including The Wolf of Wall Street. The Financial Conduct Authority and Prudential Regulation Authority have fined Goldman Sachs International £96.6 million. It was part of a larger coordinated resolution with Goldman Sachs. Coordinated resolution? That sounds like an out-of-court settlement. Over the Malaysian Development Board, 1MDB, which cost the bank $2.9 billion. So this bank is involved in massive amounts of fraud and crime, and yet one of their little protégés is now our Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Indeed, and of course it's a charmed circle that they all move.
Isn't it amazing the way the press seem to love Rishi Sunak? They just sort of, oh, isn't he wonderful? Isn't he great? What he's doing, he's giving all this money away.
Yeah, well, I think the shine's coming off that because, of course, this week he had to backtrack and agree that he was going to provide money when he'd said he wasn't going to. And, of course, he's under pressure from the Tory backwards people saying, well, we've got to balance the books, which is why they all, or most of them, voted against extending free school meals. And at the same time, they're handing out lots of contracts to their mates for, you know, completely incompetent activity.
I don't know if you saw the press conference, I think it was Wednesday, that Boris Johnson and Rishi, or maybe Thursday, yesterday, did. He looks like a sort of mannequin. He doesn't really seem to have any personality. He just reads stuff out as if he's not a very good actor, just reading it, and he doesn't seem to have any kind of depth to his character. And that's one of the things that worries me about this guy, is it all sounds like he could be a kind of almost like an AI puppet.
Well, I mean, compared to the rank incompetence in the rest of the cabinet, he comes across as somebody who can actually string a sentence together.
I suppose that's the way the city likes to work, though, isn't it? If they can be surrounded by incompetence, including, by the way, Keir Starmer, your leader in the Labour Party, mm-hmm. it makes them look better, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think the other thing is that when he came to the Treasury, there's a very good New Statesman article about all of this. The Treasury basically recognised that there was going to be a problem with the pandemic while the rest of the cabinet was still on their holidays, etc. And they put things in place, including, you know, furlough schemes, etc., ready to go. And Rishi Sunak, although he's got quite a right-wing reputation, basically agreed to go along with what the Treasury was suggesting. And that, of course, is why he had a good crisis for the first part of the crisis. Then, of course, he started to withdraw the funding. And, of course, you can't do that, as the Japanese have discovered over 30 or 40 years. Once you start bailing the economy out, you've got to carry on bailing it out.
Okay.
So the Welsh government, we mentioned the Welsh government earlier, they just nationalised the railways in Wales because there's no option. And ultimately, of course, the government is going to have to take over virtually all of the economy. Now, that, of course, really upsets the Tories because that's not what they believe in. But
well,
I'm afraid that's what's going to happen anyway.
They're doing it too. Of course they're doing it.
They're going to have to because there's no alternative.
The current chairman of the BBC is David Clementi. He's a guy, I don't remember ever seeing him much in public life, being some sort of sparkling character. He's a former deputy governor of the Bank of England. He then moved in on the nice little revolving door to take 22 years at investment bank Kleinwort Benson, becoming chief executive. His nickname at Kleinwort Benson, according to Wikipedia, was the Duke. And then he went on to become chairman of the BBC. He did a job incidentally for Lord Falconer of Iraq war crime fame. To undertake a wide-ranging independent review, of course the word independent has to be in there, of legal services in England and Wales, which of course are in disarray. Generally the standard of justice in Britain is, I mean, as you can see just by looking at Julian Assange's case, is hit rock bottom after this wonderful report that David Clementi did. But there is all sorts of jockeying, isn't there, for who's going to take over as chairman of the BBC. None of these people are people, public figures that any viewers or listeners would have any confidence in whatsoever, and they all seem to be very, very closely connected to the insiders of the privatised City of London.
Yeah, well, I mean, the BBC is definitely in the sights of Cummings and others in the government. They, I mean, I don't know if you've been watching the roadkill drama on BBC One. It's got a kind of Boris Johnson character. It's written by David Hare, the left-wing playwright. I watched it all over the last weekend. Very good, very perceptive, and very high quality drama. But the Tory MPs are going nuts about it because basically it's an attack on them, and they think that the BBC shouldn't be doing that.
But in the meantime,
sort of thing.
There's quite a scandalous book out on the Tories, isn't there? So whilst people might be switching off, watching their television, watching that, they're actually reading all about the inside goings-on.
The Swire book, yeah. Well, the thing is that BBC, you know, for many years it had Top Gear on with, pub bore Clarkson coming out with all of his Tory twaddle. And they didn't complain about that. But then other bits of the BBC, like the drama department, used to Play for Today and so on, back in the day, producing what you might call progressive critical drama. And the point about the BBC is there's something in it for everybody. But, of course, the Tories don't like the fact that it isn't just an echo chamber for the Tory press, which they regard as objective.
Well, Tory press have actually been serialising this Sacha Swire betraying of friends with her tell-all political memoir, Diary of an MP's Wife, Inside and Outside Power, lifts the lid on sex and shenanigans. Lady Swire sent diaries to a publisher last year after her husband retired as an MP. But local party members were absolutely disgusted at the breach of confidence. Well, actually, you can breach confidence in the public interest, and I would imagine Martin, you as a Labour member, would be quite happy with this sort of thing.
Well, I think she is obviously going to make quite a lot of money out of the book because it's got lots of juicy stuff in it, like David Cameron saying that he wanted to give her one when he said, David Cameron saying, "I've won a war this afternoon after the invasion of Libya." And so on and so forth. So there's all sorts of stuff in there.
Well, they have this thing in the Tory party, don't they? Do you remember with the young Tory that committed suicide, and then the guy who was responsible for it disappeared off immediately to the US, where they said isolate, inebriate, penetrate. That was the way of actually controlling young conservatives. So anybody that wasn't really part of the clique could be controlled and either brought into the clique or booted out, using those three words as a kind of mantra.
Yeah, and of course what the book does is it exposes lots of things which some people wouldn't like to be exposed. But there you go. I mean, that's, she presumably has lost a lot of friends by telling the stories that she's told, but she'll make plenty of money out of it.
Is she just doing it for the money, or do you think she feels a bit embittered as to what she... I mean, that's one of the senses I get, is that she was putting her trust and her faith in these people, as some party members do, you know, and then found that actually they weren't like the sort of people that she want. The way they were portrayed, they were completely different when she met them in the flesh.
Well, she's a very, very well-connected Tory wife, as it were. So you'd have to ask her what her motives were. Basically, there is a kind of pleasure, is there not, in exposing all this stuff and being the one to do it and all the rest of it. I presume that's the motive.
So just going back to the story I was mentioning about isolate, inebriate, penetrate, that was David Cameron's chum, Mark Clark, who was accused of bullying to the point of suicide. Police at that point launched a sexual harassment inquiry. That was way back in November 2015. But it's one of those things that sticks in the craw, rather, as the way that cliques operate, almost like cults, Martin. So if you're not in the clique, you know, you're out.
Well, as we know, there's an awful lot wrong with the way the world is run. and
but particularly political parties, isn't it?
Well, it's power, isn't it? That's what we're talking about.
I mean,
political parties are just the front. Behind that, you've got all of the. In the film Roadkill, it's all actually about arms sales and the military industrial complex. David Hare wrote the script. And the actual shenanigans within the party are actually more to do with all of this stuff behind the scenes most people don't think
about.
One of
the things Sasha Squire has said in this book is that Mrs. Cameron has shown herself for what she is. She has absolutely no class whatsoever. So, I mean, this is about class, isn't it? The British are kind of obsessed with that. And the idea that you're voting for people who are representing the upper middle class, and actually you find out that they don't have any class is a terrible thing for some.
Well, that's right. I mean, her husband, Hugo Swire, went to Eton along with Boris and others, and he was a Guards officer. And they genuinely think that this country belongs to them. And they don't like the wrong sort of person getting close to power. There's another play called Country by Trevor Griffiths, which is again a play for today. I watched that the other day, and that's about a country house party in 1945 as the Labour government is first elected and the reactions of the elites to the potential of losing their power and pelf. So, you know, the BBC, if you like, has, you know, in the past encouraged what you might call left-wing drama. Think about Ken Loach and so on.
Oh, it certainly did, but not anymore. It'd be great to have something like Play for Today back. It wouldn't exactly be that difficult. And actually, the BBC would regain its credibility. But it seems to me it's being deliberately sabotaged in the same sort of way as, you know, maybe British Rail was in the 1990s. You make British Rail not work, and then everyone calls for some change, and that change is, guess what? It's privatisation.
Yeah. Well, the Murdoch empire have wanted rid of the BBC for years. And ultimately, Cummings wants to cut them down to size. And we're going to see an awful lot of attempts to censor and to silence dissenting voices.
Well, the BBC have been doing that too, actually. And maybe that's part of the discrediting of the corporation. Anyway, leading all up to say, and I don't know if you knew this, Martin, but Rishi Sunak's ex-boss at Goldman Sachs is now a surprise candidate for BBC chairman. Richard Sharp, great name for someone in banking, Sharp Practice, an informal advisor on COVID-19 to the Chancellor, is understood to be applying for the £160,000 a year job. So Goldman Sachs, Rishi Sunak's, Rishi may have some say in this, mightn't he? He may be able to swing things for his old boss to take over the BBC.
Well, I don't know exactly what influence he would have on that, but they're basically creating, they want somebody to go in there and change the internal culture of the BBC, marketize it, allow Murdoch access to it. That's what they want to do, and they're going to try and do it.
I was pretty shocked by that, amazed, but then Goldman Sachs, the vampire squid controlling the world, should be well known to most of our listeners by now, and the idea that they want to take over the BBC too in order to privatise it is hardly come as a surprise.
Well, it's not just the privatisation. They want to change the culture of the BBC, which basically allowed a diversity of voices. They want to actually delegitimise. I mean, as you said, what they've been saying in schools, that you can't use anti-capitalist teaching materials and stuff like this. I mean, I used to teach A-level economics in state schools, and I think, how can you teach A-level economics without mentioning the word capitalism? It's just ridiculous.
Or anti-capitalism, yeah. Okay, so also on the modern version of the BBC, which I suppose is the internet, Google, things like that, and control of YouTube and social media and our searches, as we're coming up to a US presidential election, Google, one of the most powerful players in this US presidential election, Martin, we know from studies that the way that Google algorithms work can actually swing a candidate 30% approval up or down, depending on whether Google decides that they want you to find good things or bad things about that candidate.
Yep. I mean, they've done studies which show that they've got very great influence, because, of course, when you put in a search term, most people only look at the first three or four And the, you know, you've got hundreds of pages of stuff there. So
yeah, you won't find us.
Well, there you are.
I can remember for years.
This is how it works.
For years, my Bilderberg website was the first thing you put. I mean, probably for about 10, 15 years from Google in the late 90s, Google kind of popped up. And it was always the first one there. And it's slowly but surely been shunk down by, first of all, obviously by Bilderberg's own in-house website. And then also by things like Wikipedia. And now it's actually not that very easy to find at all on Google. There are other search engines I would encourage people to try using. In fact, bookmark and always use other non-Google search engines. Because Google, Martin, over the last 6 or 8 months has got, maybe a little bit longer actually, has got far, far worse. It's not actually telling you, it's not allowing you to find certain things anymore because it's decided it's blacklisting whole areas, and it's becoming an arbiter rather than an index to the internet. It's becoming an arbiter of truth and fiction. But actually what it's doing is it's presenting fiction as if it's truth and truth as if it's fiction. So it's the upside down search engine.
It is, and of course the problem with using other search engines, which of course I totally agree with, is that they simply haven't got the network capability of Google. Google, because everybody's been using it for years, they've got more stuff on there than other search engines. And other search engines struggle to keep up with the fact. So it's basically gotten monopoly power. And ultimately, of course, what you could do is you could, instead of privatizing the BBC, you could make Google into a public utility, but it was obliged to actually give everybody a fair crack of the whip in terms of being found.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about, which we're going to start doing in the next couple of weeks anyway, is providing a video box for people, because I remember when Channel 4 first started up, they used to do this, where people can just come and express their views and just come and talk for however long it is. If you don't have the technology, we have the technology, and put you up on brand new Tube or whichever platform it is, so that people can just express themselves, because I think we're moving into an era where certain views are just not seem to be acceptable, particularly views of certain doctors. But we're talking about privatisation there, and I would like now to have a listen to a woman called Debbie, who's we'll have a longer interview with her, a complete interview with her, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here's a clip with her. I mean, she's talking quite a lot in the longer clip about the COVID measures at her university. But here she is talking about the way that she's seen over the last few years the privatisation of our education system has affected her work as a politics lecturer.
I teach politics and I teach social science. Obviously, within a certain parameters of the modules that we're teaching, we do discuss things. Of course we do. You know, we look at the pros and the cons of different political theories. We look at the evidence for and against. But it's, as I said before, it's in a very controlled way, in the sense that the students are expected to give answers that are set in the curriculum, that are set in the textbooks. And for instance, I mean, the only thing I can do is compare it to my experience as a student, which is I'm sure what you were using as your reference point. If I look back to some of my university lecturers, they would stand there and they would, you know, of course they would look at other arguments, but they would tell you what they think about things. They would make a really strong argument to you one way or the other. They would not sit on the fence. And I thought that was so important, because I think as a student, when you're learning, you need to hear very strong but different viewpoints from different academics and different lecturers. Whereas now, because we are controlled, and that control, actually, I think the difference is that it's corporate now, Tony. When I mean, it was starting to kick in when I was a student, but now I give you an example, the department that I work in, and I work in a well-known university in the Midlands, the department that I work in, all of our courses, all the money comes from a private company. And I'm not going to say the name of the company, because it probably give away too much where I work, and I'd rather not say. But all the management is coming from this private company. And these people are managers. They are business people. They are not teachers. They are not lecturers. They're not specialists in any subjects that we teach. And they are telling us how to teach. They're designing our courses. And just to give you the latest thing that's happened that shows you how bad it is, they have now pre-designed all of our lectures for the semester. so that we just stand there like robots and deliver the lecture that's on the screen. We have no, as lecturers, we have no say in what we deliver. I mean, we can stand there and interpret it and get the students to discuss it. And of course, I will be doing that. And I'll do that to the best I can to open up critical thinking. But we still have to follow this new model that's kicking in. And it's all, to me, it's all taking us towards AI, artificial intelligence, where courses will be delivered on a screen, they'll be preset, and students will learn remotely.
So that's Debbie there. She didn't want to give her full name for obvious reasons. Martin, it's just like so many people in the NHS, etc. University lecturers afraid to give their real names now in case they get hauled over the calls of disciplinary for actually telling the truth about what's going on inside their institution now. The whole idea seems to be swamped by this concept of commercial confidentiality, also bringing a company into disrepute by being critical about it. Whereas actually, certainly I think when you and I were at university back in the 1970s and 80s, critical thinking was actually a key part of the way to learn.
Yes. And of course, the corporatization of the universities, the marketization of what's being provided. I mean, we've been, you know, our society has been moving that direction for 30 or 40 years now. And, you know, it's very sad state of affairs, isn't it?
One of the ironies that she points out there is that the people who are telling her what to do, her line manager, have got no experience at all in those disciplines that she's teaching to these degree students.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're dumbing it down. So a degree just becomes racing through a series of preset courses that have already been written in advance. Whereas, of course, in theory, students should be investigating things with an open mind.
So, I mean, what would you do to change it? Is there anything we can do? Can this be renationalised? I'm reminded a little bit of the books by one of the Inklings. I'm not sure which one he was, about the university. I think it was actually set in Oxford. C.S. Lewis, maybe? I can't remember. But anyway, That Hideous Strength.
That's C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis, right. And that was actually about some sort of rather nasty force within the university that they were grappling with. A very entertaining book, but it seems like many of our universities are like that now, where this is, you're basically just a cog in a machine, and the idea that you're going to be encouraged to think for yourself is out the window.
Yeah, I mean, basically they are becoming corporate factories for turning out good little workers for the corporate businesses which are going to be underlying all of this. And the marketisation of universities, for example, has led to a situation where you're gradually, you know, it's no longer a separate sphere, as it were, from the commercial world in which everything else is embedded.
It's almost as if we're moving towards a world where people are not only cogs in machines, but it's almost impossible to get a job. I mean, nowadays, for example, it's becoming incredibly difficult. I was just listening to somebody on the radio the other day who she had only managed to get any work to pay the mortgage by actually having to buy a van of her own in order to work for some sort of delivery company that she couldn't get a job where she got her own van. So she had to shell out on a vehicle for herself to work for a company. Now, in the old days, of course, you know, there's no way you would have to buy a van to get a job. All of the cards seem to be in the hands of the employers and the people with the money, the bankers, and none whatsoever in the hands of ordinary people looking for a job.
Yeah, and of course, in the long run, that undermines the efficiency of the economy because people simply haven't got enough money to buy back the stuff they've produced. And then, of course, you can lend them money, but then that ultimately leads to credit bubbles, which then burst. In the 30 glorious years after the Second World War, productivity growth was similar to as good as now, usually around 3% a year in terms of increased production. And of course, wages rose steadily because trade unions were strong. And because that was the way that the economy was run at full employment to ensure that wage growth was steady and stable.
We've
got rid of all of that because ultimately capitalism doesn't work if people haven't got any money.
Hasn't the financial system just been used as a way to enslave people?
Yes, it's a way. Of course, it has. The financialisation of capitalism since 1979.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, what previously used to happen, the stock markets were a feature of the way the capitalist economy functioned, but they weren't that important. So, for example, when Vodafone took over Siemens in Germany in the 90s, I think it was, it was absolutely horrifying because they didn't have hostile takeovers in Germany at all. They still don't have them in places like Japan. But hostile takeovers have just become normal practice in the US and Britain, which is why, of course, all of our infrastructure is owned by foreign state-owned enterprises.
Well, I'm rather reminded about that book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, the US CBS journalist from World War II, that he wrote in the early 1980s, which really described Nazi tactics before they took over countries that they occupied during World War II as using banks to buy up stock in foreign banks which had stock in those industries in that country, so using banks effectively like tanks to take over.
Yeah, well, BlackRock in the US has effectively taken over both the US Treasury and the Federal Reserve. It's a private organisation, and it's not even a bank. Goldman Sachs, we're talking about them as a bank, they're a hedge fund. They made themselves a bank in 2008 so that they could be eligible for bailout funds. Now, we've now got crony capitalism on a massive scale. And ultimately, of course, there is going to be a crash and people, and that they will walk away with the loot and
so little discussion of this in Parliament? Very, very little, actually, of the real ramifications of all this and the control by the city and a tiny oligarchy of our national affairs.
Well, that's because at least one of the parties, the Tories, are funded by the city, and many of the Tory MPs worked in the city before they became MPs, like Rishi Sunak, or they're definitely intending to go back there when they've finished. So they don't criticise it. Labour MPs also, some of them have been critical, but they're just regarded as crackpots and eccentrics.
Oh, Richard Sharp, by the way, I'll tell you to miss out this little point about him. He is a Conservative donor, and the Tories are now thinking about this. Is Rishi Sunak's former boss at Goldman Sachs, is that they want to put him in charge of the BBC.
Wouldn't you have thought that somebody like, I don't know, John Pilger, maybe even Sir Richard Attenborough, David Attenborough, you know, somebody with a sort of journalistic background? We don't need any journalists to run the TV.
The idea that you've got to have a banker running the BBC, really, I mean, that's obviously one of the reasons why the corporation's in a bit of a terrible state. And the irony is that very, very few, of course, you don't get any kind of criticism of it on Sky, because they actually want to see the BBC go down in a load of flames. Anyway, just to say, because this is all a bit depressing, let's have something a bit positive from Parliament. And somebody, if anyone was to, in the Houses of Parliament, say anything about all this stuff and dish the dirt on this lot, it would probably be my favourite MP, Zara Sultana from Coventry South. And here she is this week speaking at in quite a positive fashion to a lot of young Labour people about the nominations for the National Executive. Maybe before we hear from her, Martin, can you explain what's going on? The Labour Party is, I believe, members are voting for candidates in the National Executive.
They are, yeah. And, of course, it's it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Who are the big players in this, then? Well, is it the Corbyn Easters and the Starmerites?
It's basically the left versus the right.
That is the Corbynistas versus the
Starmerites. Well, they're not the Corbynistas anymore because he's no longer.
Well, who are? What would we call them then?
We could call them the left versus the right. I mean, there's been this struggle inside the Labour Party for many.
Okay, so who's the key?
Years.
Who's the key figure on the left if Corbyn isn't?
Well, she obviously is putting a marker down for being one of those figures. But the momentum slate for the NEC, I've forgotten the list of it. But they are quite hopeful that they are going to get all of their people elected, and I think they probably will. And that then will mean that Starmer won't get his own way 100% of the time.
Well, let's hope
we shall see.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to this week's clip from Zara Sultana speaking to the Young Labour movement this week on some sort of Zoom call or something.
Hi, everyone. My name is Zara Sultana. I'm the Labour Member of Parliament for Coventry South, and it's great to be able to join you this evening. And I'm really pleased to be backing this incredible slate of candidates. A couple of years ago, it would have been me on the other side as a candidate for the Young Labour National Committee. So I'm really excited to be here today. I actually am still technically Young Labour. I turned 27 at the end of the month, so I'm just about able to vote for this incredible slate, and I'll be doing so as soon as that ballot drops, and I encourage everyone else to do the same. And we really do need a socialist future. I think that goes without saying. From the crises we face, such as inequality and poverty, to COVID-19 and climate change, they're all caused and exacerbated by capitalism. It's capitalism that puts power and wealth in the hands of a tiny minority, letting bosses exploit workers and landlords live off the labour of workers, while working people have their hopes and potentials criminally constrained. It's capitalism that puts profit before people, even as a virus rips through our society. And it's a little surprise that this Thatcherite government has used this pandemic to hand out contracts worth millions and billions of pounds to friends and donors, lining the pockets of the rich, even when that leads us to having one of the deepest recessions of any wealthy country and the highest excess death toll in Europe. And it's capitalism that's driving the climate crisis, with fossil fuel companies pumping out carbon and trashing our planet in their pursuit of private profit. And while this all happens, while living standards plummet and working people suffer, this Tory government still finds the opportunities to scapegoat minorities, to distract and divide. During the summer, one of their MPs blamed Muslims for the spike in cases. Matt Hancock has, of course, blamed young people, and we saw Preeti Patel spent weeks of this summer trying to distract us with a supposed migrant crisis. And this government is taking us down a dark and dangerous path. In the last few weeks, they have proposed the effective decriminalisation of torture for British soldiers overseas, shipping asylum seekers over 4,000 miles away to Ascension Island, banning anti-capitalist teaching materials in our schools, and of course there's the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, or Spy Cops, which would give undercover state agents a license to murder, torture, and commit sexual violence. And like I said in Parliament, I believe we have to take this descent into authoritarianism incredibly seriously. It's not just a distraction tactic. We are seeing concrete legislation being brought in on a weekly basis that grossly enhances the powers of the state and undermines our collective civil liberties. And that's why I joined comrades from the Socialist Campaign Group in voting against the Spy Cops Bill last week. This is what we're up against, a system that's unfair, unjust, irrational, callous and cruel. A government that isn't just incompetent, I think that's letting them off quite lightly, but deeply dangerous. It's our class and young people especially being hit hardest by all of this, whether it's in the broken housing system, in the marketized higher education system, in the mental health crisis, or in precarious and low-paid work. And that's why we have to be abundantly clear that tweaking the system isn't enough. Plastic straws aren't going to save us, nor are management consultants who don't have the answer. We don't just need a better version of the status quo or more competent management of the current social order. We need bold, radical answers. We need socialist answers. In this crisis, we have seen the damage of austerity and the gutting of our public services. So let's never, ever let that happen again. We've seen how privatization enriches the few and robs the rest. So let's end it and kick out Serco out of services for good. We've seen that it's not millionaire bankers that we need in a crisis. It's our nurses, our teachers, our cleaners, our shop assistants, our bus drivers and taxi drivers. It's the working class in all of our rich diversity. So let's build a society run by and for them. Of course, this isn't going to be handed down to us. It's not going to be put on a plate. We only get things by fighting for them, by organising in our communities, in our workplaces, and yes, in our Labour Party. That's why it's crucial that we get behind people who are prepared to meet the challenges we face with answers that match their scale. That's the only way we're going to get the socialist future that we deserve. So good luck to the candidates standing, and solidarity.
So that's Zara Sultana, MP for Coventry South, Martin. One of the most interesting things I think she said there was that this is not really about incompetence. It's about a kind of dangerous, malicious group of people who don't care about the vast majority of the population. They're quite prepared to commit crimes against them and, you know, effectively bully them because they've got the power to do so.
Yeah, I mean, she's taking a stronger line than you're going to hear from the Labour front bench. They are, you know, cautious by nature and also to some extent in the pocket of the establishment.
So what's the chances of, you know, some changes happening in the Labour Party with this national executive election that she's talking about there?
Well, it's hard to say because
is Starmer biting his nails?
I don't think he's biting his nails because even if the people he wants don't win, the NEC has only got very limited powers. The Labour Party has become rather. I mean, we used to, you know, there was lots of infighting, but you used to be able to know exactly how, you know, what the infighting was about and how it would be resolved. Now it's more complex because, as you know, there's various different aspects to it. It's not just a straightforward, you know, it's a bit of a Byzantine structure, basically. But I think what will likely happen is that the momentum candidates will, in fact, win because the Labour Party membership hasn't changed dramatically. Starmer was given the benefit of the doubt, which is why he won the internal election to become the leader. But I think lots of people will feel that he mustn't be given a complete blank check to take the party in any direction that he wants to go, because we want to see some changes of the kind that have just been outlined by that comrade that we've just been listening to.
Do you still use language like that, my comrade in the Labour Party?
Well, she did.
You do?
Yep.
You do. The Prince of Wales this week's visited Harrogate's Royal Air Force Menwith Hill, a.k.a. US Air Force Menwith Hill. Actually, I don't know if there's any planes ever land there. Very few. And it's mainly used for spying, isn't it, to celebrate 60 years of operations. This comes the week after his mum visited Porton Down. So some of the most dodgy organisations in our entire country to do with military operations, secretive military operations and spying on people here in the UK, as well as creating bacteriological weapons, chemical weapons down at Porton Down. The royals seem to be very fascinated by all this right now. They seem to be going to visit them, Martin.
Well, I think that it shows. I mean, this is an authoritarian security state. The regime that we now have in power is, you know, basically, as we've seen in the Assange case, a creature of the military industrial complex, and the royals are being wheeled out to cement the relations between the official part of the state and these deeper elements.
The Prince of Wales has toured the newly dedicated Serenity Park at RAF Menwith Hill in Darley. So this is just near Harrogate, near Ilkley in Yorkshire. But what's Menwith Hill used for? Because it's been a focus for protesters for over the years, for probably 30 or 40 years maybe. And certainly I can remember when I was at college up in Ilkley in Yorkshire, we could see the radomes of Menwith Hill out of the library window.
Yeah, I think is it Purvis, the woman who's been protesting against them for many, many years?
Lindis Percy,
that's right. Well, basically it's a US spy base in Britain, and it's part of the five, you know, Britain is part of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing, and of course Six Eyes, the Israelis are also included in it. And, you know, before modern techniques of spying, which are clearly, you know, on a completely different scale from what happened in the past, and they used to be able to bug up to 10,000 phones at once from up there.
Duncan Campbell exposed, didn't he, that they had a direct link into the British telecoms network and they could listen to anything they wanted to.
Yeah. And, of course, it's not, because it's American, it's a US base, they're not subject to British law. And similarly, of course, the British can spy on people in the US, and they're not subject to US law. So the way that they finessed it was, we all spy on each other's populations.
Including the Israelis.
Indeed, yes, that's right, because they've got privileged access to all of the top information.
So what's Prince Charles's...
Even though they are, in fact, a hostile power.
So what's Prince Charles's role in all this? What, is he just going around as a ceremonial thing, or does he have any actual power?
I imagine that he is involved, but only peripherally. I mean, I was just reading about the opening of a new naval base in Bahrain, which opened in 2018, and Prince Andrew and Prince Salman Khalifa opened the base, which is what your money is being spent on, dear taxpayers. Did you want to buy a naval base in Bahrain? Well, you've got one, and you're paying for it.
Well, I'm afraid you don't score too many points on that, Martin, because the Prince of Wales maintains, the Harrogate Advertiser tells us, a very close interest in the work of the intelligence agencies. In 2011, he became the royal patron of MI5, MI6 and of GCHQ, and has regular meetings with senior representatives from each agency. His Royal Highness also presents the Prince of Wales Intelligence Community Awards to honour those whose vital work could never be celebrated publicly. So he's right in there.
Yes, and of course they're quite happy to have this relationship with the Crown, because that gets away from having any accountability to the people. And so a lot of the British deep state is enmeshed with the Crown for that reason, because the Crown is more important, for example, than the government of the day. So if you have, for example, a Labour government...
It's the permanent government, isn't it?
Yeah.
The permanent
right.
government is not just the civil service, it's the Crown. And we were hearing last week about the Defence Evaluation Research Establishment privatised version of that, Kinetic, and Serco, but mainly I'm talking here about Kinetic, being privatised with the golden share. So in other words, what Lance Murdoch was pointing out was that actually this wasn't really privatised on the stock exchanges, because the actual control of Kinetic, the privatised version of what had been the Ministry of Defence research arm, a bit like DARPA in the United States, had gone to the Crown Estates and to the Crown rather than out on the open market.
Yeah, so there's various mechanisms by which the deep state protects its assets.
Well, it seems to me like Prince Charles is very much a part of this deep state.
Yes, he is. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But whether he will know whether he was tipped off about COVID coming from China by the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States, as the Israeli Defence Forces were, I don't know whether he would have been included in that.
Well, who knows? Because if you see a whole bunch of intelligence reports, somebody somewhere has got to decide, are we going to show this to Prince Charles, and someone else will decide, well, maybe we won't.
And as you well know, in intelligence circles, you show the fewer people who see anything, the better it is. So he may go around and be talking to all these people, but he won't necessarily be being told what's exactly going on. Because that's how it works, isn't it?
Well, he will most probably be taking some sort of role in appointments, I would imagine.
I would, it's a bit of a mystery to know how these things are organised, because, of course, what's actually happened is that there isn't actually a line of command. The CIA, for example, has now become hundreds of different private sector organisations who subcontract to the government. So there isn't actually not actually clear who is doing what, and lots of things going on that, but you know,
well,
the left hand doesn't know what
the
right hand is doing.
The dodgy stuff that we've dug out, I principally have dug out about M section of MI6 during World War II grabbing Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, and all the money that he had out and bringing him to the UK at the end of the Second World War. This was all also, M section was privately funded by King George VI. It wasn't part of the Ministry of Defence funding in MI6. It was a completely separate part of it, had the same role, but it was completely under the control of the monarch of the day.
Yes, and another way they get round things is by having fingers in the international drugs industry, so that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was allowing Adolfo Calera of the FLN anti-Sandinista forces access to bring in drugs into the United States, which then funded further CIA operations in Nicaragua and elsewhere. And so the idea that there's some kind of oversight of what these organisations are doing is simply wrong. They've got various mechanisms for hiding what they actually do, and they are basically in bed with the corporate criminals who run our country and other countries.
So, thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers there. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
There's a bloke next door they nicknamed Slimy Stan. His dog slipped its lead and the way down the street he ran. It was the second time today he broke the lockdown ban. So I called the local bobby to put him in the can. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me. I snitched on me neighbour and now he's snitching on me.